Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Laura McBride is a writer and community college teacher in Las Vegas, Nevada. She says that she appreciates the beautiful and explosive possibilities of her hometown, a community in which the conventional and social boundaries are unusually fluid, where she's witnessed, she says, the power of second chances. In her debut novel, We Are Called to Rise, far from the neon lights of the Vegas Strip, lives are about to collide. A middle-aged woman attempting to revive her marriage, a returning soldier waking up in a hospital bed with no memory of how he got there, a very brave 8-year-old immigrant boy. Three lives are bound together by a split-second mistake, and a child's fate hangs in the balance. We're going to talk with Laura McBride about her novel, about living and raising kids in an exotic and perhaps ordinary place like Las Vegas, and her list of 5 books to read before dying, much else. Laura McBride's novel was a number one Indie Next pick, a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection choice, and was picked for a couple of clubs lists in the United Kingdom as well. She teaches composition literature at the College of Southern Nevada in Las Vegas. Joins us for the program today. Laura McBride, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. So you scared me.
Do I have to tell you the 5 books you should read before you die?
I've got it here in case you've forgotten. Fascinated by that. Also, the page 69 test? All of this is on LauraMcBride.com, the website. We'll get to all of that. I'm fascinated by how you got to Las Vegas, and part of the. What I learned from this book, apart from fascinating characters, some very interesting themes, for people in Utah, many visit Las Vegas, but perhaps they don't know the Las Vegas you know. So I want to start with your story. I believe you're from Spokane?
I grew up in Spokane, Washington.
How does a girl from Spokane end up in, it's not a direct path, I happen to know, to Las Vegas?
I think it would be more direct than the one I took, but I went to college, and first I went to college in California, and then I transferred to the East Coast, and when I graduated college, I had a job lined up. I wasn't very committed to it, and I had a few $100s, and I had made a promise to someone who was very dear to me that I would try to go to Paris, and so I decided to take my few $100s, and at that time there were these People's Express flights from JFK to London, and they cost $99, and you had to just wait in the JFK airport with your backpack and a few hundred other kids until there was a seat available. It took about a day and a half in the airport, as I recall. And then I took that flight, and I flew to London, where I knew someone from Spokane who lived there, who put me up for a night and took me down to the station where I took the boat, $50 to Paris. And then I arrived in Paris and I had $300 in traveler's checks. I had no way home. And it was just a little adventure, and I thought I would just figure it out for a week or two and then I would come home. And what actually happened is that I stayed for a couple of years. I met the man to whom I am now married and have been married for 29 years. He had family in Las Vegas, and he went back, and I didn't go with him. I said, oh, I'm definitely not going to Las Vegas. But as it happened, you know, family's a big draw, and we ended up here. And it took me a long time to think that I was actually going to live my life here. I moved here when I was, 23, 24, about then. And I've been here ever since. So I think a pretty common story of how people get to Las Vegas. They come with a spouse or a family member or a partner, and they come thinking that it's just a transit stop on the way. And then there's lots of reasons why people end up staying in Las Vegas, and mine are pretty ordinary ones. Mm.
There's a duality there. I mean, we think of it as exotic, but there's very American life to be had there. You wrote an interesting piece for Writers on Location. This is can be found on the website. And you say that Well, I'll just read this first paragraph. I live in a place that might be considered exotic or bizarre or fantastic, fanciful, implausible, preposterous, incredible, a long list of adjectives, often conflicting, that might be applied. And I wrote about Las Vegas not as an exotic place, but as an ordinary one.
Well, first, thank you for, you know, looking up things on my website for this interview. It's kind of you. And that actually was one of my favorite pieces that was written for a blog in the UK. I think it's a blog, or anyway, I wrote it for someone in the UK, and she asked me to write about location, and it just spurred a lot of thoughts about where I live, as did writing We Are Called to Rise. So Las Vegas is a very paradoxical kind of place. It's a place where the strip is filled with all these certain kinds of images of life and of women and of how things work. And then the sort of suburbs where people are raising their families are almost directly counter to those images, perhaps even more so than many other American cities. And that is a little bit interesting to me. What was far more fascinating to me about Las Vegas and about my life here, and especially as I've been here long enough to be able to sort of look back on it in terms of phases and various kinds of experiences, is that Las Vegas is a boomtown, and people have been pouring in here from all over the world. And we are a somewhat unique boomtown because there wasn't much of an existing infrastructure. It's not like we poured everybody into the communities that were ready and waiting for them. This is where this immigrant group went, or this is where these people with these assets went. Everybody sort of arrived in a desert that was overcrowded and with few institutions. And I think that's the element that makes Las Vegas a really interesting locale for me to write about.
Mm-hmm. And you certainly do have those some of those themes in the book. Before we get into some of that, I want to have you read a passage from the book that talks about Vegas. Tell me the story about your daughter and live nude.
Oh, hey, you gave away the punchline.
Yeah, I did. Sorry about that.
Our daughter played a lot of soccer growing up, and she practiced. Her practice fields were on the other side of Boulder Highway, which is the old highway through town. And at this point, it is lined with, you know, dirty book clubs and pornographic theaters and strip joints. And, you know, there's a lot of streets like that in Las Vegas, and I've long since stopped noticing them. And I don't think I particularly noticed her route back and forth to soccer practice probably 3 or 4 times a week. But when she was 13 years old, she had to write a speech on her motto for living. And so she worked and worked and worked on this speech, and then she gave it to us. And she said that she had seen this motto written out in a neon sign on her route back and forth to soccer practice hundreds of times. And she thought that the motto meant that one should live life boldly and fully and honestly. And then she said, "My motto is live nude."
And of course, your
family. That's really a Vegas story.
Yeah, it is. That's a Vegas story. And you said your family adopted that. You know, you live boldly, live nude.
Yes. Yeah. Live nude. Yeah. We go for that one.
I wonder if we could have you, this segues nicely into this passage I want to have you read, page 15 in We Are Called to Rise. Okay. This is Laura McBride. It's talking about kids, you know, kids growing up in this exotic / ordinary place.
Okay. This is a character named Roberta, and she's a narrator in the story, and she really exists to tell readers a little bit about Las Vegas. So here we go. The families just off the strip, the ones occupying mile after mile of nearly identical stucco houses, live conservative lives at home. Dad might be a dealer mixing with high rollers at Caesar's 5 nights a week. Mom might be a waitress wearing a butt-skimming lamé skirt at 47. But home is for another life. For first graders marching in the nearest high school's homecoming parade, for neighbors sharing abundant harvests of apricots, for peewee soccer tournaments and springtime fairs and little bags of treats left on door handles all through October. It can be cloying. It can be surprising. But after a while, it simply becomes the way it is. And the good in it, the old-fashioned neighborly niceness of it all, is one of the reasons people stay in Vegas. Stay, even if they can't explain quite why, even if they tell their friends they hate it, that the place is a dump, that off the strip there is nothing to do, even if they worry about the schools and bemoan the lack of art and feel stranded in the stark vastness of the Mojave Desert. And when the children are old enough, they move into the world their parents occupy. They grow up selling lemonade on the corner and wind up at 17 or 18 years old, parking cars at the Tropicana or waiting tables in an Italian maid's costume at the Venetian. They make a lot of money, these Insta adults, and buy fast cars, diamond bracelets, designer clothes, Cristal. $50,000 earned in valet tips is a lot of money if you're young and single, less when you're middle-aged, when you have kids and a mortgage and an array of non-specific health complaints. Maybe it was the carbon monoxide. If their parents came from somewhere else, if they were part of the rush of professionals who came to Vegas during the 80s and 90s, then the kids leave when they are old enough to go to college. They go off to Vanderbilt, the University of Michigan, SMU, and the other students call them Vegas, and they miss being able to buy nail polish or paper clips or waffles at any time of the day or night. And before too long, their hometown becomes a myth to them as well, something larger and smaller than what it really is. They don't come back, those children, and when they try, the world they miss is not there. It existed only for their childhoods, and now their friends are strange to them, caught up as they are in the world of late-night clubs, baccarat odds, celebrity parties.
Yeah, I found that very interesting, that the first part about Vegas being very American, as we like to think of it.
Yes.
Sort of with a glow on it, you know, at least the childhood part for some children.
Mm-hmm. That's been my experience, or that's one of my experiences. You know, there's so many ways for anyone to live in a place. I guess I think that Las Vegas is so often represented in particular ways, and for very clear and obvious reasons, that it isn't very often represented as many people live it. And that passage went on to talk about the children who went into the military.
Into the military.
Wanted to read that, so.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a base nearby, right? And
Nellis Air Base. Right.
And as in, you know, a lot of places, that is seen at least as economically a way up. And there's some patriotism involved as well. But the outcome, of course, is problematic. One of your characters named Luis comes back from his third tour in Iraq. Maybe more messed up than he knows. We'll talk about the characters when we come back from break. I want to get in this email. By the way, we're opening up the phone lines, an email for you. You can interact with Laura McBride, whose very interesting novel is set in Las Vegas. We Are Called to Rise is the name of it. It's gotten rave reviews, got a lot of great response. And we're coming kind of late in the game here, but you still have some events. Let me get those. You're part of, Laura McBride is part of Nevada Reads, so she'll be on February 20th at Mesquite Library in Mesquite, 11 a.m., and on that same day, February 20th, back in Las Vegas at the North Las Vegas Library. Some other events as well coming up in Colorado and Connecticut, Dallas, and other places. You can find that at lauramcbride.com. So before we go to break, this email from Glenn. He says, although my Vegas experience isn't as exciting as your guests, my, quote, near-stranded experience, unquote, as a Utahn who visits regularly is this. I drove down in a $50,000 pickup and came back home in a $150,000 Greyhound.
Oh, dear. Sorry, Glenn.
Yeah, that's somewhat typical, but people still keep going back. I don't know, Glenn, if you still keep going back. He says, great show. So thanks, Glenn. You can email
Thank
us
you,
to
Glenn.
upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. And you can also reach us by telephone to UPR to 1-800-826-1495. That's toll free anywhere you're listening, 1-800-826-1495. We'll learn about some of the fascinating characters in the novel and how the novel got started. It's fascinating and, I guess, inspirational. I found it inspirational. Laura McBride essentially locked herself at home and put her nose to the grindstone, and it all came out very well. More following the break.
Remarkable Women is made possible with support from the Center for Women and Gender at Utah State University. Aline Smith Walker was born in Ogden, Utah. She received her bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degree from BYU, Stanford, and the University of Utah. She led the Healthcare Reform Task Force. Walker was also chair of the National Conference of Lieutenant Governors and president of the National Association of Secretaries of State. She was a leader in the Utah House of Representatives and was also Utah's first woman governor. Remarkable Women is made possible with support from the Center for Women and Gender at Utah State University, providing students another perspective of current societal issues. Information at womenandgender.usu.edu.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour is Laura McBride. She teaches at community college. She's a writer. Her debut novel is a pretty big hit. We Are Called to Rise. It's out from Simon & Schuster in paperback now. And you can join us here on the conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Or upraxis@gmail.com. Perhaps, like Glenn, you'd like to tell us your Vegas story. Would that be the exotic side or the more Americana side, as we've been learning here? And this novel features some fascinating characters. A middle-aged woman attempting to revive her marriage, a returning soldier waking up in a hospital bed with no memory of how he got there, and a very brave 8-year-old immigrant boy. Three lives are bound together by a split-second mistake, and a child's fate hangs in the balance. We have Laura McBride with us for the hour. So Laura McBride, I was reading how this novel came about. I believe you had written a previous novel, gotten no nibbles at all.
None
at all. And so you had in mind maybe to write another novel, and through a series of actually misfortunes, I guess, things which could be viewed as misfortunes at the time, you got some time to write.
Yes. Well, there was quite a long time between I wrote a novel when my children were really small. I quit working when my second child was born for a couple of years. And I wrote a novel, you know, whenever he was asleep or whenever both kids were in preschool for a minute or whatever it was. And I worked on that novel really hard. I was so proud of it. And I couldn't get anyone to read it, much less reject it. And looking back with what I know, I don't think I had the best plan for how to put that novel out. But certainly my experience of that, which was, you know, a tremendous amount of effort, and was, this is not a practical career. And I need a job, and I need health insurance. And, you know, I'm too old to just sort of keep dreaming. I was quite young then, but I felt that I was too old. So I really put away the idea of writing for a long time. You know, I went and I ended up getting a tenure track position at the College of Southern Nevada. And I may have told myself that if I were a community college teacher, I could write on the side. That would be a very naive way of looking at what a community college teacher does. But I very quickly gave that up and threw myself into the college and no longer saw myself as someone who would be writing a novel. And then I had a sabbatical coming up, and I had applied to be part of a doctoral program at UNLV. And it was a cohort that met every 2 years. And so I was anticipating that I would begin that cohort, I think it was in July of 2009. I could have the year wrong because I'm not great on that stuff. But in any case, and then that I would spend my sabbatical in the spring of 2012 writing my doctoral thesis. What actually happened is that at the very last moment, I received a one-line email from UNLV in June of that year. The doctoral program was canceled for budget cuts. And then there was about a year that went by in which they thought the doctoral program would be coming back. And I had, in preparation for working full-time and being in the doctoral program, removed myself from all of the committee assignments and administrative work and extracurricular things that I had been doing at the college. And so I'd kind of shaken up my life, and I, to be perfectly honest, I was really frustrated with how state employees and community college employees were treated in those whole difficult times for the entire country, and very difficult times in the state of Nevada. And I didn't want to give back my sabbatical because there was no longer a doctorate. I felt that I had already taken a pay cut and a bunch of other humilities, and I wasn't willing to do it. And then I tried to my children were just starting college, and I tried to come up with some other practical thing that I could do that would, you know, earn me more money. And it was the recession, and none of those things worked out. And finally, I just thought, well, okay, I've tried really hard to be practical and to do the right thing, but I have a semester sabbatical, and I can't do anything practical, so I'm going to write a novel. And I wrote it believing that I was doing it just for the creative experience of doing it and for the joy that comes with finishing a project, not always with being in the middle of a project, but with finishing it. And that it ended up getting published and taking this crazy journey that it has taken is just, I guess it's a lesson. It's certainly ironic. It's a lot of fun for me.
And you took the same advice I believe you would give your writing students, right? You, if you're going to do it, right? Set a goal.
Yeah.
And put your nose to the grindstone.
I spend my life persuading students who don't like to write that they are going to write. And, I have three pieces of advice I always give my students when it's time to actually write the paper. I say, do it in one sitting, follow your roadmap, and don't sweat the small stuff. And I wasn't aware of it when I was writing the novel, but looking back, I realized that I had done exactly that I had created a roadmap for myself, that I sat down and I did it every single day at the same time, 7 days a week, where only a true emergency could pull me away from it. And I let go all my fears and a lot of perfectionism, and I just let the process happen and let the characters come to me and let the book write itself. And when things would go badly, or I would be in kind of a mess in terms of the plot, or I would recognize that I had done something that was, not great writing, I would just say, that's okay. You got up, you wrote this morning, you worked for 6 hours and you're done. And I wouldn't worry about it. And the next day or a week later or whenever it happened that I was interested in that passage again, I'd go back and fix it. Mm. So I think that becoming a community college teacher and trying really hard to teach other people how to write ended up teaching me a lot about it, too.
Good advice for life, too. And even if you're not a writer, you keep at it, persistence, perseverance. I want to talk about one of the kernels of, inspiration for the book. You sat down to write it in 2012, as I understand it, but you thought back to a tragedy incident that happened there in Vegas in 2008. Tell me about that.
Well, I had kind of thought of myself as a storyteller and a possible novelist for most of my life. And while I had given up any real intention to do that 7 or 8 years before I wrote We Are Called to Rise, I was still in the habit of kind of inventing stories to myself and inventing novels. And and I would do this on my commute to work, or if I was stuck waiting in a doctor's office, or, you know, it was just kind of a habit of mind. And so when I sat down to write a novel, I had a few novels kind of blocked out in my head, and I had some characters that I'd been thinking about or considering for years. And I actually froze. I couldn't decide which one of those stories I would actually write now that I was going to write one of them down. And I spent, a few months prior to the sabbatical beginning, sort of tossing these back and forth in my head and actually driving myself crazy and trying to consider, you know, what would be the right way to choose one of these stories. Like, should I choose the one that would other people would find interesting? Well, no one was ever going to read this novel. Should I choose the one that might get published? Well, I wasn't going to get published. Should I choose the one that my kids would like, because maybe they would read it when they were older? And, you know, round and round and round, driving myself crazy. And in that period of time, every once in a while, I would have this little sort of this thought about this thing that had happened in Las Vegas 4 years before. And it was a very sad story. It was a kind of upsetting piece of news that stuck in my head, and it had long stuck in my head. And I would think to myself, you know, what about that? And then I would think, oh, I have no interest in writing about something so sad. So on the day that I told myself I would be writing that morning at 8 a.m., my fingers would be on the keyboard, something would be typed, I still had not decided on the story that I was really going to tell. And so at 8 o'clock, I just said, type something, and I typed, oh, the ice cream lady. And that was that little zit of a story that had happened in 2008. And honestly, I think I thought what I was doing at that time was blocking out a novel and getting started to rid myself of all these fears I had about finally starting to write again. And that in a week or two, I would have relaxed, I would be in the groove, and then I would choose one of the novels that I had long intended to write. But as it happened, that story caught my attention. I didn't write about the incident in 2008. I took the germ of that incident. I didn't do any research on it, and I made it the center of the novel. And then I tried to work myself out from it. Like, how would that have happened? And what would have happened before? And what would have happened after? And yeah, that's how it works. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually give away the plot there, but I can if you want me to. Book's been out a long time.
Yeah, if you're okay with doing that, I don't want to, you know, ruin the read for people.
Well,
but
I won't
as
give
much
away really
as much as you
novel.
Can.
The
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actual incident was a woman who was shot by a police officer and killed after her husband was stopped for just a traffic violation. And she actually, in the real story, not in my book, I don't believe that she was even there for the traffic stop. Her husband called her and she came. And when she came, she brought her young children with her. And I really don't know anything about what really happened that day or who was involved. I've never spoken with anyone involved in that incident. In no way is my novel a retelling of that real incident. In no way. Mm-hmm. But the drama inherent in that and the trauma of it stuck in my head. And when I used that incident as the germ of a novel, it allowed me to get to a lot of themes and issues and ideas that I had about the place where I lived, Las Vegas. And none of that was conscious in my head. I wasn't thinking, oh, this is a story that will allow me to do this or that will point out that or that will reveal these ideas about Las Vegas. I think maybe that those things were at the level of my unconscious mind, because when I was all done, I realized how well that particular germ of an idea carried the things that I wanted to say. Mm-hmm. But creatively, that happened at a below the consciousness level, not at the conscious level.
And you've said that, I'm reading an interview that you gave to the Salt Lake Tribune in 2014. By the way, this book was part of the Utah Lit. It's been chosen for many book groups.
With Alan Fagg,
yeah. Yeah, very, very good interview here. And you say, after a tragedy, all we have is how we choose to go forward.
Yeah, I think, I think some people escape a certain amount of tragedy and trauma in their lives, but certainly many, many people don't. And I haven't. So I've given a lot of thought in my life for a long time about the aftermath of a traumatic or a tragic event and the experiences of loss and of grief. I'm a pretty upbeat, chipper sort as a, just a way of being in the world. But I think my motivating temperament has a sadder side, actually. Mm-hmm. I think these are the things that we need help with. And I wasn't writing a book to help anyone. I was just writing a book to be entertaining. But I guess the act of creating something, of really caring about something. And I think this is true in any way that we pour our creative souls into something. You know, it's true when I make when I try hard to make a fabulous dinner, or when I stitch a quilt, or when I work in my garden. And it's true when I write, that you're bringing your whole self to it when it's your best work. And I guess those are the ideas that interest me.
I wonder, before we go to our next break, I wonder if you could read us just another paragraph from your books, page 20.
Okay.
We're talking with Laura McBride. We Are Called to Rise is the novel. And this is the 8-year-old Albanian boy. The family has come to Las Vegas. Mother, father.
And just this. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and then there's a little sister. She was born in America. Anyway.
I'm not sure I'm on the right page.
Okay.
Did you say 20?
Page 20.
Does it start with "at my school"?
No, this is talking about Mrs. Monahan from Australia. It might be a different page.
Oh, okay.
Page
just that
here.
One paragraph?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or the two? Okay.
Just the one paragraph, yeah.
All right. Mrs. Monahan is his third grade teacher. And he says, Mrs. Monahan is from Australia, and she says things in an Australia way. I like the way Mr. Ernie talks. Mr. Ernie is the crossing guard. I like the way Mr. Ernie talks, and I like the way Mrs. Monahan talks. But I think it's funny how grown-ups speak with their accents at school. At home, I speak Albanian, or sometimes American that sounds Albanian, but at school, I just speak regular American. That's how all the kids do it. On the playground, Felicia and Santiago speak in Spanish, and with Mrs. Lopez, they speak American that sounds Spanish. But in class, they speak regular American. So I don't know why Mr. Ernie and Mrs. Monahan always use their home voices. Mrs. Monahan and Mr. Ernie have been here a long time. And in Australia, it is not even a different language.
And this is Boschke's voice. I think you get the child very well. It's seen from a innocent child's point of view. One of the things I got from that is, children. The way children see things, they're very malleable, very, very changeable. They're still developing.
Yeah.
Another part of this is Boschke's life, right? He's had to move around a lot. He has to move between a lot of different worlds.
Yes, and when I was, so the book is written in first-person voices, and so about a fourth of the time, I am in the first-person voice of an 8-year-old boy from Albania. And I thought, this is a really bad narrative choice when I made it. But in fact, the experience of writing in Boschke's voice was really moving. And the way that I would do it is I sort of compare it to what I think I know about method acting, which is that I would sit down and I would imagine myself as a young child, and a young child who has a certain amount of trauma and at home, and who has this other kind of life as an immigrant and in an immigrant family at home, and who loves school, loves his teacher. And I would imagine, you know, what would this little boy be thinking as his teacher was talking, as some other child was doing some ordinary thing? What would he be thinking about, and what would he care about? The really interesting thing about writing in the voice of Bashkim is that after I would finish writing for the day and I would be going about my ordinary Laura McBride day, I would still see the world and hear the world and feel the world a little bit in the way that an 8-year-old child might. So I'd be at the grocery store and I would notice things I would never notice. And I would overhear things that would never strike my ear. And it would always take a few hours to kind of shake that 8-year-old child completely out of my system. Hmm. And he was, I guess, in my experience of that, he was so much more sensitive to the immediate. And there was so much that he didn't pass over and ignore, which I think is maybe pretty typical of at least some children.
Yeah, I think we hope if they're in a difficult situation, we hope they're not, you know, internalizing it. But they usually are. They're usually noticing a lot more than we hope they are. And Bashkim has a difficult life. He has to walk in the door. He has to take the emotional temperature of the family. And the father is violent, kind of based off of very violent things he experienced back in Albania.
Right. And he also, like many immigrant children, he's a little bit the interpreter for his family. So both his parents speak English, but they don't speak it as easily and as clearly as Bashkim does. And more than just speaking a language, Bashkim is comfortably American. He can pick up signals from his teacher, from the principal, from the police officer, that he recognizes his parents do not interpret quite correctly. And that's a lot of responsibility for an 8-year-old. And again, I think a common immigrant experience.
I want to get to the rest of your main characters here, some very fascinating characters. And before we go to break, I want to slide over back to your article about for the writers on location about raising kids in Vegas. So we're talking about children, Bashkim. You write, "My children have never been in a group, at school or on a team while at play, in which anyone would assume a shared cultural position on almost anything. Las Vegas is a boom town," you write, "filled with people from all over the world." And you wrote elsewhere that maybe the borders, the divisions are a little more fluid in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you talk about that, especially from the point of view of the kids, maybe with your children and the people mm-hmm. that they associate with.
So first, a caveat. I mean, Las Vegas is growing up, and it's different now in 2016 than it was in the 90s when my children were born, and in the 2000s when I was raising them. But one of the things that was true about the boom years when 4,000 people a week or whatever was the statistic were moving in here is that there wasn't enough of anything. There weren't enough schools or parks or emergency services or houses or places to live or libraries or just you name it. There was a shortage of everything. And one tended to live wherever there was either an apartment building or a house being built in the month that you came to town. And, so many things were less solidified, less rigid is too strong a word, but less set in stone than they are now. And so in my experience, we were constantly living with and interacting with people who were different from us and different economically and different religiously and different politically and different culturally. And my kids, who just went to the zoned schools and played on whatever teams they were on, were constantly in these environments where they were eating strange food, they were learning different languages, they were interacting with people in lots of different ways. And I don't think that I was very conscious of the beauty or the benefit of that in any particular way. It was so much just the way it was. And often it was in the middle of, you know, chaotic growth and classrooms that were huge and other kinds of frustrations that one might have. And it wasn't really until my oldest daughter went to college in 2009 and that I started to see how well prepared she was for a 21st century world and how very accustomed she was to to mixing with people and not just bumping shoulders, not just a nodding acquaintance, but really being in their homes and doing projects with people and working with them. And, you know, she had one friend who was arranging a her family was arranging a marriage for her, and other kids who were getting married kind of early, and other kids who were, you know, traveling around the world to do different sorts of work. I guess I can't come with the concluding sentence here, but I recognized the sort of beauty in all of that after it was over. Not mm-hmm. necessarily, not that it was over, but after it was over for my children, not necessarily when they were in it.
And you said Vegas is growing up. What do you mean by that? And is that a good thing, bad thing? What's going to be gained or lost?
Just a real thing. Mm-hmm. And we're still a boom town, but at a much, much slower level. Our schools are still terribly overcrowded. There's a lot more planning in the development of homes and the development of neighborhoods. And I guess I might be the only Las Vegan that finds that a little bit sad. I see us sorting ourselves into our proper divides as fast as we can, you know, with everyone with this amount of assets lives or these values lives together. This is kind of an American phenomenon that is often talked about, that people who have certain political values or certain assets or certain career aspirations all go to the same places in the country and huddle together. And I guess my one little useless personal insight into the world is that seems to me all wrong. It seems to me that we humans do better when we are really shoulder to shoulder, mixed up, connected to people who live and think and feel differently than we do. And I didn't want to live my life in Las Vegas, and I didn't want to raise my children here. That was my idea about it. And yet I feel that I got so much more from this experience than I would have gotten if I'd been able to choose the exact community that I thought would be right for me. I feel like it enriched my life, enriched my children's lives, and showed me, I think, how the world could really work if we didn't sort into our divides so seriously.
I want to talk about another divide that this probably is, I don't know, it's maybe more fascinating to people on the outside than people who live in Vegas. But that's this boom town and sort of the Americana, a very attractive Americana that you describe, childhood in Vegas.
Oh,
right. And the Strip, you know, the casinos and, you know, Sin City. And is there, how much of a divide is there? Or how much is that permeable and back and forth?
Well, I think it, you know, it really depends on, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to live in Las Vegas and a lot of different ways to incorporate the Strip. And so certainly there are people for whom the Strip or gambling is a major component of why they came to live here, whether for work or because they're professional gamblers or just because they like the nightlife. But there's a very large community of people, if not the majority of people, who are living lives more or less removed from the Strip. And if the Strip impacts all of us because it's our major economy, because it's how people live, okay. But beyond that, have relatively little interaction with it. And I think that, I think that it's kind of like any company town. It's pervasive, and it's also can be something almost ignored. You know, I know lots and lots of people who never go to the Strip. And my children, this is another funny thing, though they did go to the Strip sometimes for, like, at dances, there would, you know, all the kids would get in a bus and go to some fantastic show, which is something we would not have done in Spokane, Washington. When they get to college, their friends know more about Las Vegas than they do. And that's pretty funny. But, you know, as a Las Vegas kid, we're not just trotting them down to run through a casino.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine, yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, I'll just alert you, Laura McBride. I'll have you read a passage from page 197. Beautiful passage from Avis. We'll learn about Avis, fascinating character, and Luis following the break.
Renewable energy is gaining momentum across the country.
But what are your options? You've read about windmills, you've heard about solar panels, but how do you take the next step? Utah Public Radio wants to hear from you. For example, with a small family living in a little outdated apartment in rural Utah, how can you convert to clean energy? Visit upr.org/upin, become a source with the Utah Public Insight Network, and submit your questions about renewable energy to UPR, and tell us, what do you want to know?
Thank you for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm speaking with Laura McBride. Her debut novel is quite a hit. It's got rave reviews. It's out now in paperback from Simon & Schuster. It's called We Are Called to Rise. Here's the plot in brief. A middle-aged woman attempts to revive her marriage. A returning soldier is waking up in a hospital bed with no memory of how he got there. And a very brave 8-year-old immigrant boy is involved. Three lives are bound together by a split-second mistake, and a child's fate hangs in the balance. The novel is set in Las Vegas, which is Laura McBride's hometown. She teaches composition literature at College of Southern Nevada in Las Vegas. You can join this conversation at 1-800-826-1495 or email to upraccess@gmail.com. So I want to get to a couple of other main characters here. First, Laura McBride, Avis, is that how you pronounce it? She's a woman whose marriage looks like it's falling apart.
Yes. Avis was a difficult character for me to write and a difficult character for me to finally understand. So I had this little incident at the center of the book that I was building from and around. And I decided that one part of the story would best be told by the mother of the main actor. And the mother is Avis. And looking back, I can think that maybe just knowing that she was the mother of the actor was not quite enough, to know about her. But I also think that she was difficult to write because she was a middle-aged woman. At the time that I wrote her and in my conception of her, she was about, you know, a generation ahead of me. Her children would have babysat mine. But I was really protective of my own life and my own friends. And every time I would write something, I would sort of cross it out and say, no, I'm not putting that in the book. But in the opening chapter, when it what I would do is I would create it. I had a list of chapters, was sort of my my pre-writing setup, and in each chapter I would have named the character who was going to narrate it: Avis, Louise, Boshkeem, and eventually Roberta. And I would give myself a task or a plot point that I wanted the reader to get from that chapter. And so, in the opening chapter of the book, which is Avis, I wanted the reader to know something about her relationship with her husband, and I knew that her relationship with her husband was not in a great place and it was in flux. And the little thought that I had was, I mean, there's so many ways to reveal to a reader that a long-term marriage is not going well. But the little thought that I had was, well, what if I were to put them in an intimate moment, and what if that intimate moment were to go badly? And then I would just let it roll. And that's how Avis came to be. Avis is someone who had a really traumatic childhood of her own, might have ended up a kind of lost person. But in my imagination of her, she's fundamentally very, very strong. And she's someone who is going to survive her difficult childhood. And she ends up married to an up-and-coming casino executive and having a life for 25 years that is middle class and then upper middle class and a little bit public and a little bit social, that is completely contrary to anything she knew as a child. And she sort of makes it up. She makes up how does a wife behave? How does a mother behave? What does a family look like? What should I be doing? And she's always looking in the world for clues as to, you know, how she's supposed to live this life. She tries very, very hard. And at the moment where we meet her in this novel, her marriage is coming apart. Her child has significant issues. He's a grown man. And it seems to all be unraveling on her, all this effort she's put into her life for so long. And that's kind of the moment where we meet Avis.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary opening passage to the book. You'll have to read it. We're running out of time. I want to get this. Glenn has written back in, especially engaging with this program. I want to get that email in. Glenn says, I have to say today's show has been especially close to my heart. I, too, have spent my life concocting stories in my mind, always with the intent of eventually putting them down, arranging them and writing a book. I, too, have felt like I settled rather than I lived at times, which I think is some of underlying sentiments today. Today has been really inspiring. I should say that I have recently started writing. I'm off to a good start, except that I have one question. How do you overcome your own second guessing about your abilities? And when do you decide that what you have is okay? I have some trouble with the fact that some things are so personal, though not personal experience per se, but that I feel a little vulnerable. So that's from Glenn. So, Laura McBride, what do you say?
Well, Glenn, you know, bravo to be writing, and thank you for paying such close attention. You've actually asked a really complex question, but I think if there was a couple of simple answers. One, in my experience, I had to be really kind to myself, and I had to set goals that I could actually meet. Like, I will write for 4 hours today, not I will write something good today, or that writing will mean anything. And when I finished whatever my goal was, 4 hours, I patted myself on the back. I gave myself some sort of treat. And I said, bravo, Laura, you did it. You wrote for 4 hours. Because it isn't always good, and you don't always know where it's going. And it would really stop me to sort of try to evaluate what I was doing. And in terms of personal exposure, I was really protective of the details of my life and my family because I'm not very confessional, and I didn't want to share those things. But writing is personal. You reveal your heart and you reveal the way you see the world. And I think you kind of, I mean, I don't have advice for that. I realized that, especially after the book was published, that there was no way around it. And it's an ongoing experience of feeling that I've bared too much myself or feeling vulnerable to that or of just accepting that other people may take that well or may take that poorly. I'm glad that I don't write confessional work, but everybody thinks that I'm Avis or Roberta anyway, so I'm not sure what I gain.
Right.
So just keep doing it. Bravo, Glenn.
Yeah, I echo that. Bravo, Glenn. Good luck with that. Keep at it. Maybe we'll see your work up there in lights, as they say. I'm glad you're working on that. So we have reached the end of our hour. A couple of matters of unfinished business we'll put on our website. A beautiful passage from page 197. If that's okay, we'll put that paragraph on the website. It's just a beautiful passage in the voice of Avis. And we'll also put a link to Laura McBride's five books to read before you die as well. So we'll put that on.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Laura McBride has been our guest. Her novel is getting a lot of favorable attention. We Are Called to Rise. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. And can I just say that Utah has been wonderful to me and Salt Lake City in particular, and I love you. Thank you.
Great. And hope you'll join us again tomorrow for Access Utah. Thanks for listening today.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.